This is Bradcast producer Desi Doyen. We're off today. Today's Bradcast was originally recorded on November 19th, 2024.
What you're saying is that specifically in those two states, in Arizona and Nevada, we saw 5% and 7% of the ballots were people who only voted for Trump?
That is what the numbers are showing us. And all I got to do is actually do a hand recount and prove me wrong.
Okay. Challenge accepted. If it was up to me.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN, up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO and Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Richmond, Virginia's WRWK, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. All right, we have got a lot, I hope, to get to on today's show, including some new disturbing details, frankly, on some of Donald Trump's insane announced nominees for his second administration. The legal battles underway in Pennsylvania over the upcoming recount in the very tight U.S. Senate race between Democratic incumbent Senator Bob Casey and his Republican challenger, Dave McCormick. And, of course, our latest Green News report with Desi Doyen,
yay,
as usual, chalked full of stuff. We'll see what we get to today.
Oh, we'll get to that.
We'll get to as much as we can in any event. Given, frankly, that the Trump era firehouse of news.
Fire hose of news.
See, I told you. Fire hose of news is already returning, along with the need with it to triage our coverage often on the fly based on what we can and can't get to in any one Bradcast hour. This is one of those hours. I've been hearing quite a bit from listeners and bradblog.com readers and commenters, etc., on this following my interview last week with computer scientist Duncan Buell of the University of South Carolina. He is one of a group of cybersecurity and voting system experts who sent a letter last week to Vice President Kamala Harris advising her to seek hand recounts, or at least hand audits of a few precincts of paper ballots in a number of key battleground states, given the known history going back to 2021 of Trump supporters often unlawfully breaching, copying, and distributing over the internet proprietary voting system software from states like Georgia and Pennsylvania and Michigan and Colorado, etc., after Trump lost the election to Joe Biden. Some of those folks have gone to jail for that. Others are still facing legal charges for it. And also, I've heard from folks following a similar call for hand counting paper ballots in swing states that is that has been made by a guy named Stephen Spoonamore, who I've known him for years. He's got a background as a sort of a white hat hacker in the financial industry, working for credit card companies and such to actually hack systems in a way to catch the black hat hackers, the bad guys who are doing the same to those same systems in order to actually defraud the credit card companies in various ways. Spoonamore's job was to catch them and stop them. So over the past week or so, including in my conversation with Professor Buell on this show, you can download it and all of our shows that we've ever done for free at bradblog.com, I have referenced some of the concerns that Spoonamore has published on the internet since November 5 on his social media accounts and now at Substack, sometimes with a bit more certainty about certain elements of this than I am comfortable with. But that does not matter. Describing why he, like the experts on the letter that we covered last week, is also advising Kamala Harris to seek hand recounts in a number of key battleground states while there is still time to do so in order to get confidence that the results announced about the election, as tabulated by almost entirely computers, is actually correct and accurate as per voter intent. Now, Spoonamore has now sent two so-called duty to warn letters, as he describes them, to the vice president, explaining his reasons why he believes that hand counts are needed to make certain that she actually lost in those battleground states. He's got a number of reasons for his arguments that are somewhat different than the well-documented points about stolen voting system software that is detailed in that letter from the group of computer scientists and cybersecurity and voting system experts that we reported on in detail on this program last week, along with my interview with Professor Buell, who is one of the signers of that letter. So Spoonamore has a number of theories for his case. I want to talk about a few of them. They're focused mostly on his concern about so-called bullet ballots in several battleground states, which I'll explain what those are in a second, as well as the evacuations that occurred on Election Day in more than 50 largely Democratic-leaning precincts in a number of states on Election Day, threats that were said to have been sent, according to the U.S. intelligence community, from Russian-associated email domains. And he argues the fact that Trump supporter Elon Musk, who spent some $200 million getting Trump elected, that Musk owns a satellite internet system called Starlink, which some jurisdictions reportedly used for internet connections at precincts on Election Day. Though, to my understanding, the known use of the Starlink system was not necessarily particularly broad, and where it was used at voting precincts, it most likely would have been used for electronic poll books as opposed to actual voting machines or ballot scanning tabulators, etc. But Spoonamore's central theory of the case as to why he believes the election results are fraudulent is what he describes as an unusually large number of so-called bullet ballots, which you heard him talking about with my friend Tom Hartman at the top of the show there. So a few points on that for the moment. First, what Spoonamore is referring to as bullet ballots, which are ballots that feature one single vote on them. In this case, as he characterizes it, one single vote for Donald Trump and then for nobody else on the ballot. But what Spoonamore is talking about are not necessarily bullet ballots, because we don't actually have that data yet from the election to know, you know, how many bullet ballots there actually are. We don't actually know how many ballots of that type were actually cast. He also, perhaps more accurately, has now begun referring to those as drop-off ballots, which is probably a bit more accurate, because what he seems to be referring to is ballots which have a vote for president on them, but not a vote for the next highest race on the same ballot. in most of the battleground states this year, that would be a vote for a Senate, most likely, a Senate race. In fact, those ballots may actually not be bullet ballots because they may have votes for other candidates and issues and so forth. But from how I have heard him myself describe it, his assessment seems to be based on the number of presidential votes in a particular location minus the number of votes for the next highest race on the ballot. Now, there are always that kind of vote in any election. Full bullet ballots are a little bit more unusual, but there are always people that vote that way as well for just one candidate.
Or they'll just vote for a couple of races where they feel confident who they want to choose, and then they leave the rest blank.
Right. But Spoonmore's argument is that there were not only way more of those types of ballots this year, whatever you want to call them, bullet ballots, drop-off ballots, whatever it is, but, you know, if one wants to make the argument that the Trump campaign was, as they were, targeting low propensity voters and essentially telling them, look, just go in, vote for Trump, deposit your ballot, and that's all you need to do. Well, if that happened, it wouldn't, you know, explain what Spoonmore is citing as a huge number of those types of ballots only in the battleground states, while neighboring states, which, you know, could be in the same media markets, et cetera, saw the normal tiny number of such ballots. So that's where his concern seems to come from centrally. A lot of these particular type of ballots, whatever you want to call them, in the critical battleground states, and then right next door, you know, the normal amount of that type of ballot. That these bullet ballots or drop-off ballots, however you want to describe them, that they only occurred in battleground states and no place else. So that's his basic argument. He also suggests that jurisdictions which had supposedly Russian-sourced bomb threats could have been done in order to add cover in the event of a recount after the election to say, hey, when the jurisdiction was evacuated, the chain of custody for ballots was lost, so we can't count those ballots. We have no idea if the results there are accurate or not. That's also a part of his argument. And in what seems a little bit less plausible, at least to me, given the way the voting and tabulation systems work, he also has suggested that Elon Musk's Starlink system could somehow be used for various chicanery as well
as
on election day.
As a vector.
But frankly, it does not matter whether any of that is plausible or not. He comes to the same conclusion that the computer scientists and voting system experts came to in their own letter last week, but for different reasons. Which is, if you have concerns about any of these things, for whatever the reasons are, there is only one thing to do, which is count the ballots by hand. That's it. So, you know, the scientists who wrote that letter that we reported on last week are not quite as certain about fraud. They don't, as a matter of fact, they say they see no evidence of fraud. Spoonmore sees evidence of fraud. He's been pretty assertive about it. These other folks are not. But again, it doesn't matter which of them is wrong or right. Count the ballots by hand. That's the solution. And as it turns out, that's the same exact solution that I've been calling for years, actually decades now at this point, when there are concerns about the accuracy of computer tallied results, whether the reported winner is a Democrat or a Republican or anything else. That's the way to answer that question if the people involved actually want that question answered, which is a separate matter. Now, I've called for the hand counts in these sorts of cases where people had questions, partisan questions, you know, about elections going back to at least 2004, whether it was the Democrat John Kerry in Ohio at the time or Republican Donald Trump supporters across the country in 2020, or questions about whether Democrat Hillary Clinton actually lost to Trump in 2016 in another very close election, or whether Hillary actually beat Bernie Sanders in the 2016 Democratic primary elections. The answer is always the same. If you're not sure, count the ballots. or at least fight like hell to do so. All of the statistical analyses in the world claiming that these results could not possibly be correct. How could you have that sort of bullet ballot in one place and not in the other? Or, you know, there's a one in a trillion chance that such and such could possibly be accurate, such and such a result. Ultimately, as I've said to partisans on all sides of the aisle, after they receive election results that they may not like, for good reasons or bad, the solution is always the same. Count the frickin' ballots and find out. Now, to be clear, I'm in favor of it. I was in favor of it when it was Trumpers who had these concerns. Despite the lack of evidence to support their suspicions, they deserve to know whether their candidate won or lost. And we deserve, to have opposition who is not constantly questioning the results. I was in favor of it when Democrats had concerns about any number of elections. Count the ballots. That's what they are actually there for, believe it or not. And those who tell you that hand counts are somehow less accurate than machine counts, we hear that a lot from supposedly legitimate, reporters. Well, they usually have no real evidence for that other than some very limited years-old studies on voting systems that are not actually in use anymore. They're very small studies, or they had to do with, counting all of the races on the ballot by hand and how long that might take versus just one single race that there might be questions about. The gold standard, as I have described it now for more than 20 years in elections, when you really, really need to know who won the closest of elections, what do? You publicly hand count the results. And if those concerns exist today in the Harris-Trump race, given concerns about voting system breaches by Trumpers in recent years or statistical analyses of so-called bullet ballots, etc., there is an easy solution. Count the ballots. Spoonamore, who is, as I said, a bit more certain of fraud in this election than I am, based on the evidence currently available, he says, as you heard him at the top of the show, prove me wrong, hand count the ballots and find out. So, whether I agree with his assessment or anyone else's 100% does not actually matter. We all came to the same conclusion, which is hand count the ballots. Or at the very least, a sampling of the ballots, if counting all of them in any one jurisdiction is somehow too much to ask for any reason. Now, I should also note, by the way, that a hand count is not dispositive. An American election could be stolen, at least in very sophisticated schemes, in such a way that even a hand count of all the ballots might not expose the fraud. For example, in Centre County, Pennsylvania, which is where Stephen Spoonamore actually lives, there was an incident that I have raised several times over the past 2 weeks where some 13,000 absentee ballots were said to have been properly scanned on election day, but when the results from those scans were then uploaded to the central tabulator to, be mixed with all of the other results, well, those absentee ballots, for some reason, did not show up in the aggregator results, and we don't know why. It's still unknown, at least to me and to others on the ground in Center County. We saw a similar situation, still unexplained to my knowledge, in the town of Battle Creek in Calhoun County, Michigan, where some scanned ballots, absentee ballots again, did not initially register properly in the election management system for some reason. In both cases, thankfully, the problems were noticed. Center County, Pennsylvania, by the way, was one of the jurisdictions that also experienced one of those hoax bomb threats on election day, as Spoonamore has pointed out. Now, I've been in touch with some folks in Pennsylvania about all of this since election day, including folks on the ground in Center County. The good news, according to a source of mine who was there, on Monday this week, the county did do a hand-counted audit of four precincts. The source reports back to me that ballots from Election Day, absentee mail-ins from the precincts, military and provisionals ballots from each precinct were all included in that hand count audit, and the quote, all numbers matched the initial computer reported results. That is very good news. That said, it's also possible that it wasn't a large enough sample to detect fraud. And more to the point here, as I'm trying to point out how a hand count cannot absolutely dispel the chances that the election was defrauded, the question of why those ballots failed to upload to the central tabulator originally, that is still a mystery. Has the software been manipulated in some way? If so, was it a malware attack that went awry? Or was it, as we saw, for example, in Antrim County, Michigan, back in 2020, a mismatch between the databases on one end at the precincts versus the database on the receiving end at county headquarters, where there were different candidates on each line in both databases? Things did not match up. The results came out screwy. It was noticed, corrected, fixed, investigated, and discovered that they had the wrong databases, or they had different databases on each side, different software on each side. So a scientific evaluation on both the sending and receiving end of results in a place like Center County, Pennsylvania this year would be necessary to confirm whether that's what happened this time and to figure out what went wrong. Was it a simple programming error that happens? See Antrim County 2020, or a more nefarious hack or something else. But it all starts with hand counts. Hand counts of paper ballots. That's what they're there for. And it does not matter whether you agree with Spoonamore's theories or the other experts, or whether you can justify what Spoonamore is calling bullet ballots, or you don't think it's possible to hack software on a voting system, even if you know that they have stolen proprietary software years in advance. None of that matters. The only way to know if a computer has tallied results accurately is to hand count those ballots by hand and do so publicly, so we can all know that they were counted accurately. I will add that over the years, I've heard criticism from partisans on all sides of the aisle claiming that, well, whatever my coverage was on a different election, oh, that proved that I'm not doing it this time. I must be in the bag for some candidate on this election, or vice versa. I hear that all the time. It's weird because my coverage is almost always the same. I don't actually care about your statistical analyses. I know it makes some partisans angry at me, or why you think an election might be right or wrong, because this could be explained by this or that. Or that it smells fishy somehow, or my favorite, this stinks to high heaven. None of that matters. Doesn't matter. Count the ballots. John Kerry supporters, or Hillary Clinton supporters, or Bernie Sanders supporters, or Trump supporters, or Kamala Harris supporters, if you are concerned, publicly hand count the ballots.
I think I'm detecting a pattern here. I think you're saying count the ballots.
Well, it only took me 20 years for you to get it, Desi Doyen. But yeah, that's kind of what I'm saying. Then, of course, you are going to run into the difficulty of hand counting the ballots. States go out of their way to make that as difficult as possible. Just ask the Green Party's Jill Stein. She tried to do it in three different battleground states back in 2016, and for various reasons in each of them was blocked from doing so in part or in whole in all three of those states. But that's a different story. It's a different fight for the moment. If you have concerns about the results of this year's presidential election, your best hope right now is to hope for the Harris-Walz campaign to raise these concerns on their own and demand hand counts where she can get them, since they have the best legal standing to request them. Democrats are generally very afraid of doing that. They always have been. Republicans, not so much. They don't care. But Democrats always have been, for fear of being, called conspiracy theorists or tinfoil hat wearers. And I get that. And that is now, by the way, way more true fear than ever, given how far Democrats went to wield that weapon themselves against Republicans. And by the way, in most cases, justifiably so, during 2020, against the evidence-free Republican claims of fraud in 2020. But even back then, I said, yeah, count the ballots. But that is where we are. What you do with that information for now, I will leave to you. My hope is simply to clarify what we know and what we don't know and what can be done and can't be done about any of it. Specifically about what can be done. If folks, particularly the Democrats and Kamala Harris, decide to step up to offer confidence in our electoral system with a hand count of at least some of the ballots cast in this year's absolutely critical presidential election. What was it Kamala Harris used to say? When we fight, we win? Okay. Please do. Please proceed, Madam Vice President. All right. Got that out of my system for the moment. I'm sure it'll return. In related news today, speaking of jurisdictions in some or whole attempting to prevent the counting of ballots, as the New York Times reported on Sunday, in an election defined in part by a tsunami of litigation before polls even opened, a few states saw as much legal haggling over which ballots should count. Few states saw as much legal haggling as the great state of Pennsylvania. The polls, they write, have long since closed, yet a new round of litigation is flooding the recount battle between three-term incumbent Democratic Senator Bob Casey and Republican Dave McCormick, a hedge fund CEO and Casey's Republican challenger, who currently, according to the computerized tallies in Pennsylvania, leads Bob Casey by about 17,000 votes, which sounds like a lot, but it is just 0.25% out of nearly 7 million votes that were tallied in Pennsylvania's U.S. Senate contest this year. That margin, though slim, the Times describes as rarely overtaken by a simple recount. The landscape, they note, however, is different this year in that at least four counties, Bucks County, Philadelphia County, Center County, yes, Center County getting a lot of action this year, and Montgomery County, in those counties, local election officials are acting in open defiance of a ruling from the Pennsylvania Supreme Court that arrived weeks before the election when the court found that mail-in ballots that are missing the date on the outer envelope or that have the wrong date, that those cannot be counted for this election. Now, the court did not decide that on the merits. They just largely came to that decision thanks to jurisdictional reasons. So what does that mean? Well, we're talking about the date that, for example, might go right next to where the voter is supposed to sign their ballot. On the outer envelope, but where, and this happens all the time, where the voter might either not notice that they're supposed to fill in that field, or they forget to include the date there, or they put the date of the election in that slot instead, or the date of their own birthday, or they put the correct date that they filled it out, but they might write the year incorrectly as 2020 instead of 24. It's absolutely meaningless. That date. It's used for nothing. And we're talking about votes that arrive in advance of the election day deadline in Pennsylvania, you know, either dropped off or they're postmarked before election day, etc., and where the signatures match the voters on file. And the only issue with the ballot is that the date was somehow filled out incorrectly, even though it's used for absolutely nothing and the ballot has arrived in time to be counted with all of the other ballots.
So in other words, these are properly registered voters who are making very minor technical errors that have no bearing on whether they're legal voters or whether their ballot itself inside the envelope is legal.
That's right.
Immaterial.
That's right. Yet that is what Republicans went to court for in advance of the election this year in hopes of getting a ruling from the state's high court to throw out any such ballots on their gamble that more Democrats than Republicans use mail-in votes, and therefore if you throw away a certain number of them with mistakes that are, you know, on the meaningless date field on the outer envelope, that you'll probably be throwing out more Democratic votes than Republican ones. That's the argument. That's the reason that the Republicans are, challenged these type of votes in the first place. Because they want to win elections, no matter what they need to do, even if it includes disenfranchising thousands of perfectly legal voters and ballots in the bargain. They don't care. And Republicans were, in fact, successful toward that end before the election in getting a ruling, even though it wasn't on the merits, but getting a ruling from the Pennsylvania Supreme Court that such ballots may not be counted, despite rulings over the years from other courts around the state that have made clear for years that ballots cannot be tossed out for trivial reasons that have no effect on the legitimacy of the actual ballot in question. Which is why Democrats in parts of the state over the past week have been attempting to defy the state Supreme Court's ruling. Quote, "It is a pretty stupid thing to not count someone's vote simply because they didn't date an envelope for a ballot," said Robert Harvey, the Democratic chair of the Bucks County Election Commission Board and a Democrat. During a meeting last week where the board voted 2-1 to go ahead and count 405 ballots with date errors on the envelope. He added that the election officials know when those ballots were printed for the voters, making the outer envelope date requirement absolutely meaningless. He said the law needs to be changed. The commissioners were advised that they were likely to be sued no matter how they ruled on this matter. Quote, "So we're going to get sued either way. I'd rather be on the side of counting ballots than not counting them," said Mr. Harvey. Almost immediately, sure enough, the McCormick campaign sued the county, demanding that it obey the Pennsylvania Supreme Court guidance and not count those ballots, even though the ballots were unlikely to affect the outcome in Dave McCormick's U.S. Senate race. The Republican National Committee also moved to intervene in this case to prevent those ballots from being counted. Throughout this year, election officials in Pennsylvania, a key battleground state with 19 electoral college votes and a critical Senate race, navigated judicial whiplash with envelopes missing the date, ballots arriving late, whether election officials could permit voters to fix any issues with their mail ballots, etc. In every case, as you might imagine, Republicans were against counting otherwise perfectly valid votes. 2 days after voting to count ballots last week with misdated envelopes, Diane Ellis Marseglia, another Democratic member of the Bucks County Board, expressed her frustration with the recent court ruling. She said, quote, "I think we all know that precedent by a court doesn't matter anymore in this country." Kind of hard to argue with that. That's what she said as she voted to count the some provisional ballots that were barred by court order where voters did not sign one of two different required boxes. She said people violate laws anytime they want. And of course, thanks to our U.S. Supreme Court, frankly, it's pretty hard to dispute her assertion, I am very sorry to say. She hinted that her decision was an attempt to spur renewed consideration by the state Supreme Court, which did not actually rule on the merits of the decision originally in their decision to not count absentee ballots. She said, quote, "For me, if I violate this law, it's because I want a court to pay attention. There's nothing more important than counting votes." Well, on Monday, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court issued another decision, even as it is still not based on the merit, but they ordered that election officials must abide by the earlier decision and they must stop counting mail-in ballots that were invalidated because of the incorrect date on the outer envelope. It's a major victory for the Republican Senate candidate David McCormick ahead of a statewide recount. They called it a, quote, "massive setback to Senator Casey's attempt to count illegal ballots." Hmm. The automatic recount begins this week. It must be concluded by November 26th. And as I understand it, and I'm trying to learn more, but as I understand it, counties may choose to count, to recount those ballots either by hand or by using a different tabulation machine than they initially used to conduct the election. I hope that most of those counties choose to count by hand. I fear that most will use computers instead. Ironically, by the way, or pathetically, depending on how you want to look at it, back in 2022, the first time Dave McCormick ran for the Senate when he narrowly lost the Republican Senate primary, back then, McCormick argued for those very same ballots to be counted when he was on the losing end of a narrow race. Anyway, the Pennsylvania High Court in its decision on Monday said the counties, quote, shall comply with the prior rulings of this court in which we have clarified that mail-in and absentee ballots that fail to comply with the requirements of the Pennsylvania Election Code shall not be counted. Republicans have previously argued that the law was as set by the state legislature says the outer envelope shall be dated and election officials must follow the letter of the law. Whether that is in compliance with the state constitution or the U.S. Constitution or anything else, Republicans, even though there is a Democrat controlling the Democratic governor in Pennsylvania, Republicans control enough of the state legislature that they were able to, well, not clarify this law that has been unclear for years. And that's just how Republicans apparently like it. After the ruling this week from the high court, Donald Trump's campaign manager, Chris LaCivita, shared the news on social media and wrote, quote, okay, so now let's get the state police involved, suggesting there was going to be law enforcement coming out against these election officials. Just to give you an idea of the police state that we are now likely headed into under a new Trump administration. Everywhere in this nation. The legal director of the ACLU of Pennsylvania, which has been involved in most of the litigation, said that commissioners are, quote, justifiably frustrated that the legislature has refused to fix this eminently fixable problem. Seth Bluestein, a Republican Philadelphia commissioner who voted against counting those ballots, said he did so despite his personal belief that the date is immaterial to whether a person is eligible to vote. He cited an earlier court decision saying that those could be counted. Anyway, Neil Makija, a Democratic Montgomery County commissioner, voted to count the ballots, arguing that he was erring on the side of voting rights. There's an idea. He said Monday that while he respects the state Supreme Court decision, it, quote, unfortunately means that thousands of votes cast by lawfully registered citizens will be thrown out in this election. An election decided by just 17,000 votes out of 7 million cast, or 1/4 of 1% of those who voted. I'm sure I'll have a few words for those who didn't vote at another time, but I got to get to a break. Speaking of our coming police state, an update on the sex trafficking of minors allegations, allegedly by Donald Trump's nominee to become the next top law enforcement officer in the nation. That's after a quick break. I'm Brad Friedman, and you're listening to The Bradcast. Hey, this is Brad. Here at The Bradcast and bradblog.com, we fight for election integrity all year around, like no other media outlet in the nation. But of course, we need your help to help us remain on your public airwaves and completely independent. Please help us continue that fight over your public airwaves by stopping by bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
You're listening to an encore presentation of The Bradcast.
Walking down the street, pretty woman.
There's a reason that I'm playing that particular song. Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from BradBlog.com. We will reveal that in a moment. As we noted on yesterday's program, the U.S. House Ethics Committee is meeting on Wednesday to determine what will be done with their years-long investigation into Matt Gaetz, Congressman Matt Gaetz, following his resignation from Congress last week on the day that he was nominated by Donald Trump to be the next U.S. Attorney General. But prior to that meeting of the bipartisan committee, on Monday, a lawyer this week, a lawyer representing two women, not one as previously reported, but two, who testified that former Congressman Matt Gaetz paid them for sex, told multiple news outlets on Monday that one of the women described witnessing Gaetz having sex with an underaged girl at a party in 2017. Despite these allegations, long investigated by the Department of Justice, more recently by the bipartisan House Ethics Committee, and despite the fact that Gaetz has zero experience, by the way, at the Department of Justice or running a huge organization, or even much experience at all as an actual attorney, Donald Trump announced that he is nominating Gaetz as the next U.S. Attorney General, the nation's top law enforcement official. Now, the lawyer for these women, Joel Leppard, told CBS News, ABC News, CNN about his client's testimony, these two women, to the House Ethics Committee, which was investigating allegations about Gaetz and young women, as well as accusations of illicit drug use. Here's part of Leppard's conversation with Major Garrett, formerly of Fox News, now of CBS News, on Monday, just to give you sort of a PG-13 version of what these women have testified about to the House committee.
She arrived at the party. She had sex with Representative Gaetz within minutes of her arrival. Later on, when she was walking out to the pool area, she observed to her right Representative Gaetz having sex with her friend, who was 17 at the time.
And on this question, she's absolutely sure.
She's absolutely certain that she observed seeing her friend and Representative Gaetz having sex against what she described as a game table of some sort.
If the House Ethics Committee report were to be made public, what do you think it would reveal?
My clients want to know that this happened and it's real. They do want the public to know that they are not lying. They did not come forward willingly. They've never spoken to anyone without the force of a legal subpoena. The testimonies of her and the other 11 individuals that testified would show that this actually did happen, and the American people would know, and they could decide if that's the person they want to be the next Attorney General of the United States.
11 other individuals that testified to the House committee on this matter? 11?
That seems like a lot.
After Gaetz's resignation last week, when Trump nominated him on the same day. And by the way, he did not have to resign right now. He could have waited until next year, continued to serve as a Congress member. But he knew that the Ethics Committee would be meeting the very next day last week to decide whether or not to release their report on this, a meeting which has since been pushed back to this week on Wednesday. After the resignation, the GOP House Speaker Mike Johnson, a self-proclaimed very, very devout Christian, announced that he did not want to make the report public because Gaetz was no longer in office, and therefore he claimed House rules barred its release, even though it's been done several times in the past after members have resigned.
In other words, Speaker Johnson lied.
Both women also reportedly told the committee that they were paid for sex using Venmo. The attorney, Leppard, said that that the House committee has tons of receipts, literal receipts on all of this, text messages on all of this about, you know, the arrangements to pay these girls to meet up with them, apparently meet at one point to meet Gaetz in New York during one of his appearances on Fox News. And then to go to a performance for, ironically enough, a musical version of Pretty Woman on Broadway. Which, what's that about again, Des? Someone paying, a rich guy paying someone for sex? Anyway, Gaetz has, of course, denied the allegations. A spokesperson for the Trump transition said, quote, Matt Gaetz will be the next attorney general. He's the right man for the job and will end the weaponization of our justice system. These are baseless allegations intended to derail the second Trump administration. Well, actually, they were not intended to derail. These allegations have been around for years now. And the report is compiled in the U.S. House, whether it's released or not. It was compiled by a bipartisan House Ethics Committee, five Republicans, five Democrats. And the justice system, by the way, has not been weaponized, at least not under Joe Biden. Sadly, it decidedly was weaponized under the first Trump administration, which investigated and audited and attempted to prosecute a number of Trump's perceived enemies, like Hillary Clinton, some of her associates, Hunter Biden, the current president's son. So whether the report is from the House Ethics Committee is released or not, at least 10 members of the House Ethics Committee, and I suspect many of their staffers, have seen this report. Or they, you know, still have access to that report, which is said to be very damning, as you heard, of Matt Gaetz, putting him at serious risk of blackmail if it is not released, because it could be used by any number of people, foreign or domestic, as leverage against the next attorney general, which is why people like that are not nominated for such important posts, at least in normal administrations. In this one, the Trump transition team is bypassing the regular vetting of potential nominees by the FBI, hiring a private company to do it instead, as we discussed on yesterday's show with the former Deputy Assistant Attorney General and the former Chief Counsel for Nominations in the U.S. Senate, Lisa Graves. She told me,
what you're seeing here is an absolute rejection of the rules. These are the rules that help keep America safe and help keep our information safe and help ensure that we don't have people in high positions who are subject to blackmail, for example, who might be pressured by a foreign leader or a corporation to do things that are contrary to the American interest.
Right. That's the whole point of a proper vetting and finding people who don't have something that can be used against them. Lisa Graves went on to say, quote, for people who are seeking access to our most sensitive information, there are additional national security assessments. The investigators are looking at, do you have stability, trustworthiness, reliability, discretion? Do you have good character and judgment, honesty, and unquestionable loyalty to the U.S.? To ensure that people get positions of trust with access to our most sensitive information, that they have unquestioned loyalty to the U.S. and not to a foreign power. She says, when you look at the people that Trump has said he will nominate, including Matt Gaetz, many of them have serious defects in this area, in more than one of those categories, said Graves. But aside from the 10 members of Congress plus their staffers who now have access to that information that could be used as leverage over the next U.S. Attorney General if Donald Trump really moves forward with this guy's nomination, well, we also have this today from the New York Times. An unidentified hacker has gained access to a computer file shared in a secure link among lawyers whose clients have given damaging testimony related to Matt Gaetz. That, according to a person with knowledge of the activity, the file of 24 exhibits is said to include sworn testimony by a woman who said she had sex with Gaetz in 2017 when she was 17 years old, as well as corroborating testimony by a second woman who said that she witnessed the encounter. The information was downloaded by a person at 1:23 p.m. on Monday this week. According to the person, a lawyer connected to the case sent an email to the address only to be informed in an automated reply that the recipient does not exist. The material does not appear to have been made public by the hacker, at least not yet. The documents include information that is under seal with the Justice Department, which investigated Gates but did not file charges, and with the House Ethics Committee, which has completed its own inquiry into the former congressman. The hacked trove of documents stem from an altogether different source, a civil suit apparently being pursued by a friend of Matt Gaetz's, who filed the suit against both the woman who said she had sex with Gaetz when she was a minor and a guy named Joel Greenberg, a longtime friend of Gaetz, who is now serving an 11-year prison sentence after pleading guilty to federal sex trafficking charges involving that woman and cooperating with officials. The man who filed this lawsuit has claimed that he was defamed by Greenberg and by the woman, both of whom had told federal authorities that the man had hosted parties where he and they and Gaetz and others took drugs and openly had sex. So it ain't just the 10 members of the House Ethics Committee and their staffers who have access to this information. Now there's someone out there who was able to hack into these files who also has this and could also use this against the next U.S. Attorney General. The material apparently taken is unredacted, includes the names and other personal information of the witnesses, but is otherwise said to be more damaging to Gaetz than to his accusers, according to the person familiar with the hack. The hacker had not contacted the lawyers as of Tuesday morning, and it was not clear what motive that person might have had. Whatever it was, are you kidding me? Really? He's going to move forward with Matt Gaetz? Seriously?
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of The Bradcast. I know. I'm running late.
Yes, we are.
Let's go. Our latest green news report.
There is no climate crisis.
Trump nominates climate science deniers and fossil fuel profiteers to head key agencies. Winters are warming up quickly across the U.S. Plus,
we don't have to choose between the environment and the economy.
President Biden offers hope for climate action, the first president ever to visit Brazil's rainforest.
All of those hopes and fears and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
The question now is, which government will stand in the way and which will seize the enormous economic opportunity?
Oh, I know which one will stand in the way. I bet you do, too. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, you have been very busy, unfortunately, over the past week or so, trying to keep up with all of Donald Trump's appointments meant to destroy the climate.
Yes, but we'll get to that in a moment. First, a new analysis warns that global carbon dioxide emissions from the burning of fossil fuels are set to reach new record highs in 2024. However, the rate of emissions growth is slowing, according to the Global Carbon Project.
Bending the curve?
Yes. Scientists say humanity must cut emissions by 40% by 2030 to have a chance at avoiding the worst impacts of man-made climate change in coming decades. The researchers also found that nature helpfully continues to absorb about half of humanity's emissions, but that the rate of carbon uptake in forests and other systems itself is slowing down. If it seems like winters are getting warmer in the U.S., you are right. According to a new study by nonprofit data firm Climate Central, winters are warming quickly across most of the lower 48 due to man-made climate change driven by the burning of fossil fuels.
Yay, golf all year round.
States with the fastest warming rates were Minnesota, Wisconsin, New York, Vermont, and Maine. Warmer winters are already impacting winter sports, the outdoor recreation tourism sector, and crucially, water supplies. In politics, Republican President-elect Donald Trump nominated a fracking executive, Chris Wright, a climate science denier who has no government experience, as his Secretary of Energy.
Chris Wrong.
The Department of Energy's primary focus is on managing the nation's nuclear weapons stockpile and cutting-edge energy research. The Biden Energy Department expanded clean energy innovation to address climate change, like solar, batteries, next-generation nuclear and advanced geothermal energy. But Chris Wright denies the reality of climate change and its accelerating deadly impact. Here's Wright in a post he made on social media.
There is no climate crisis, and we're not in the midst of an energy transition either.
As I said, Chris Wright, you're very, very wrong.
Trump also nominated North Dakota's Republican Governor Doug Burgum for Interior Secretary, where he is expected to reverse President Biden's focus on conservation and renewable energy policy. Burgum also will head up a brand new government entity that Trump says he will create to cut regulations across multiple agencies and fast-track fossil fuel extraction on the public's lands.
So, growing the government in order to shrink it.
As governor, however, Burgum did support wind and solar projects in his state alongside oil and gas.
That's good.
And he reportedly supports some of the clean energy subsidies that Trump is seeking to kill off that are driving major investments in red states. To head the Department of Transportation, which manages the nation's vast infrastructure, its aviation system, railroads, highways, and ports, and which has been key in modernizing our infrastructure for climate resilience, Trump nominated former Republican congressman and Fox News TV host Sean Duffy, who also has zero experience in government management.
Perfect.
President Biden in Brazil for the G20 summit on Sunday became the first sitting U.S. president to visit the Amazon rainforest to announce new U.S. investments in reforestation and to call attention to the dangers of climate change and the economic benefits of shifting to clean energy. Biden cited the manufacturing and jobs boom generated by his historic Inflation Reduction Act, and he echoed experts who say that while the clean energy transition in the U.S. may hit some speed bumps, it is now unstoppable.
We don't have to choose between the environment and the economy. We can do both. We've proven it back home. I will leave my successor and my country in a strong foundation to build on if they choose to do so. It's true, some may seek to deny or delay the clean energy revolution that's underway in America. But nobody can reverse it. Nobody.
We'll see. For much more on all of those stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the social medias at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
I'm unstoppable today.
We'll see how unstoppable. Thank you very much, Desi Doyen.
Yep.
Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show, want to hear it again, want to share it with someone you know, love, or hate, you can download it for free at bradblog.com. That is made possible by those of you kind enough to help us stay on your public airwaves by hitting the donate button or going to bradblog.com/donate. Drop me email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the social medias, I am The Brad Blog. See you there. Until we see you here next time, hopefully tomorrow, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
I'm unstoppable.